You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charlie Ebinger, the Director of the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings within the Brookings Foreign Policy Program. We are delighted to co-host this event today with our colleagues from the Africa Growth Initiative. And we're particularly delighted and thankful that Dr. Birol and Ambassador Bisa have made themselves available today to join us for this event. What we're going to do this morning is I am going to introduce Ambassador Williams and Jonathan Elkind, excuse me for not mentioning you initially. And then we will have Ambassador Williams' formal remarks, at which point Mr. Elkind will then come up and introduce Dr. Birol, and we will, following Dr. Birol's presentation, have a group come up on stage for a moderated discussion. Ambassador Williams is a career member of the Senior Foreign Service with the rank of Minister Counselor and is currently Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of African Affairs at the State Department, with major responsibilities for West Africa and African economic policy issues. She has a very distinguished career, having served as U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Niger from 2010 to 2013, and she has also served as the coordinator for Cuban affairs in the Bureau for Western Hemispheres in the department from 2007 to 2010. And she has also served as acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for Western Hemispheric Affairs, covering all of Central America, the Caribbean, and Cuba in 2010. You have her biography in front of you, so I won't go through it all. But obviously, she has received a number of meritorious awards for distinguished service in a wide array of capacities at the State Department. She is a proud native, her bio says, of Trenton, New Jersey. That seems to be what New Jersey people do. And she holds a Master of Science degree in National Security Strategy from the National War College of the National Defense University in Washington, a Master of Arts in comparative literature from the University of California. And she received her BA degree, cum laude, in Black Literature of the Americas from Yale. Now let me just, before we call on her, let me also introduce Mr. Elkind. It's particularly nice to have John back at Brookings, where of course he was before he joined the Department of Energy. He currently serves as the Acting Assistant Secretary for the Office of International Affairs and DOE, and in the past served as the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Office of Policy and International Affairs between 2009 and 2013. Prior to joining the Energy Department, he worked as a senior fellow at Brookings, focusing on energy security and foreign policy. He also had his own consulting firm and has served in a number of distinguished positions on the National Security Council. John received a Master's of Business degree from the University of Maryland, and he also has a Master's degree in Soviet History from Columbia University and a Bachelor's degree from the University of Michigan. Without further ado, I would like to welcome Ambassador Williams to the stage.
Thank you, Charlie, and good morning, everyone. Glad to be here. Charlie said he's going to give me time to do my formal remarks. My remarks really are going to point out a couple of factoids, to give you a sense of what we're looking at in the State Department as we talk about energy in Africa. But again, I'd like to thank you. I'd especially like to thank the IEA for its continued engagement with African countries on energy issues, and also congratulate you on this report on Africa's energy outlook. The U.S. partnership with IEA and with Brookings in promoting global energy security, affordability, and accessibility really is extremely important and has been very fruitful. Many African countries have experienced strong economic growth in recent years. Increasing access to electricity on the continent will help ensure that Africans are able to take full advantage of this growth and to achieve meaningful economic and social development. The African energy sector could bring a new balance to oil and gas markets. Almost 30% of global oil and gas discoveries made over the last 5 years have been in sub-Saharan Africa. The U.S.-Africa Energy Ministerial, which was held in Addis Ababa in June, resulted in a collaborative agreement to develop a clear roadmap to catalyze sustainable energy development across the African continent. The participating countries were committed to engaging the private sector and to promoting regional cooperation to advance clean and efficient energy deployment and to explore effective business models in mini-grid development. As a focus on energy infrastructure continues to develop and improve, the energy needs of vulnerable communities, including rural areas and women, have to be considered and integrated into country and regional energy strategies. Expanding energy access to women and others on the periphery is not only critical to increasing energy access, but also to promoting economic growth. Thus, off-grid and mini-grid solutions are critical to sustainable and equitable growth and development on the African continent. Additionally, Africa experiences a significant disconnect between its vast resources and its capability to generate and distribute electricity. Financial, technical, and regulatory assistance is needed to bridge this gap. It should be emphasized that only about 1 in 3 Africans, 1 in 3, has access to electricity. And the total number of persons without access is increasing, not diminishing. One of the ways the United States government is responding to this is through our Power Africa initiative, which I'm sure most of you have heard about. The Power Africa initiative aims to add more than 30,000 megawatts of cleaner, more efficient electricity generation capacity and to increase electricity access by 60 million connections to households and enterprises. The U.S. government is committed to Power Africa and to other energy engagements in Africa to increase private sector investment in the energy and power sector, to improve management of the region's resources, and to strengthen regional energy cooperation. By collecting and disseminating this comprehensive look at the current state of energy use and access in sub-Saharan Africa, the IEA has created a common reference point for all of us to use from which plans, progress, and need can be gauged. Sound policy must be factually based. U.S. economic and environmental sustainability agendas revolve around energy production and consumption. No single vision of the future is ever the right one, and no analysis can capture the full range of the opportunities. However, the IEA's efforts have incorporated diverse perspectives from stakeholders around the world, the State Department included, who have interests in Africa's growth and its success. We thank you for that, and I welcome this forum. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jonathan Elkind, and as Charlie has already noted, it's kind of a double pleasure for me to be here with you today, both to introduce somebody whom I hold in the highest regard, Dr. Fatih Birol, from the International Energy Agency, but also simply to return to Brookings. I think that the role of the International Energy Agency is well known to those of you in this audience. It helps its member countries by conducting high-quality analysis, monitoring of energy markets and trends, and helping us as members chart our way, our path to the energy future that we need to find ourselves in. In this context, Fatih Birol has played an exceptionally important role, not only as a senior economist at the IEA, but also as a thought leader both inside and outside of that institution. Through his leadership of the World Energy Outlook, the flagship annual publication of IEA, IEA has developed an unrivaled voice, identifying the signal characteristics and developments that we see in our global energy world, identifying and providing quantitative understanding of critical issues like the role of fossil fuel subsidies, the challenges around energy access, the opportunities that exist in key non-member partners like Iraq, Russia, and in this current edition of the WEO, our African partners. In addition to that, Fatih has built very strong relationships between the IEA and the international energy business community through the Energy Business Council, and so in that, in many regards, he has provided a critical voice in our global energy architecture. I particularly salute Fatih and his team for highlighting in this chapter, in this series of chapters that will appear in the upcoming World Energy Outlook, the diversity, the opportunity, and the challenges that exist in the African energy context. This work also underscores the importance of our engaging with African partners, which I know is something that is close to Fatih's heart. So with that, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Fatih Birol.
So a very good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much to Brookings Institute once again inviting the IEA here to share our views about the, this time on Africa. But many thanks to Ambassador Williams to be present here and to tell us now and perhaps during the discussion the views and the engagement of the U.S. government on African energy issues. A great thanks to John Elkind. He's one of the our guides in our governing board about the global energy picture and who did provide several support for this study, ranging from providing input, peer reviewing, and bringing us in contact with many important partners looking at Africa, one of them being the Power Africa Initiative, with whom we work very closely throughout this study. We also work very closely with the African Union, African Development Bank, African Energy Commission, several African governments, and this is this report, which get a lot of echo in Africa and beyond, is a product of a big team, about 40 people at the IEA, and I am very happy that today I have the privilege of two of my colleagues with me today, Mrs. Rebecca Gagan, who is one of our senior managers, who is the head of our communication, and Matt Frank, a distinguished member of the World Energy Outlook team. So coming to our work, where are we today in terms of Sub-Saharan Africa? We said it's Africa Energy Outlook, but we did concentrate on Sub-Saharan Africa. The main reason being is that North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa have, they have very different energy context. And therefore, we did concentrate on Sub-Saharan Africa. And when you look at the numbers, we always say that Africa is underdeveloped, growth is not satisfactory. They are all fine. But when you look at the numbers, in the last 10 years, the economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa was about 5% per year, which is only the second to Asia. Strong growth, but despite that, we see about 400 million people are under the extreme poverty line, which is $1.25 per day. And one of the major findings of our study, and I will try to refer to that in the next minutes to come, is that energy is absolutely critical for the economic and social development of the continent. The region, Sub-Saharan Africa, accounts about 13% of the global population and only 4% of the global energy use. And out of this 4%, half of it is biomass, namely wood, agricultural waste, and animal waste, which has major consequences, as I will elaborate in the next few minutes. There are many energy issues and challenges in the region, but if I have to pick up one, it is the poor electricity infrastructure. And here we have two problems. One of them is we all of us acknowledge, which is the access to electricity, as Madam Ambassador also highlighted. The second one is, in many cases, there is electricity network, but there are many outages. You don't know when the electricity comes, when it goes, how long, and this is a big uncertainty there. The electricity infrastructure is the main impediment, we think, to growth. The resource base, energy resource base, is huge, both in terms of oil, gas and coal, fossil fuels, and at the same time, renewable energy is a huge untapped potential. And the good news is that many countries, many governments now realized that the addressing the energy is a must. Energy is a must. Making reform is a must if their economic growth efforts are to be successful. And here, I said there are resources, there is a lack of access to energy. The missing link is the investments for infrastructure, which is the main threat of our study. And when I say investments, again, one data point which I find interesting. Currently, or when you look at the last 10 years average, out of $3 invested in the sub-Saharan African energy sector, out of $3, $2 are for the projects to export the African energy to the consumers, their oil, gas, and coal to Europe, North America, or Asia. $1 is for the investments to provide energy for the domestic people. So $2 for the export projects, $1 for the domestic projects. This is something we think may need to change in the next years to come. Now, in terms of the resources, huge resources. Oil and gas, as Madam Ambassador mentioned, is one of our findings, that in the last 5 years, about one-third of the new discoveries, oil and gas discoveries in the world, were in sub-Saharan Africa. This is huge in terms of oil and gas in West Africa, East Africa, new discoveries, and coal also in Southern Africa. Huge resources. But the main richness of the resource in the renewables, hydropower, major resources, especially in Central Africa, and currently only 10% of this potential is being exploited. It is a very, very, very low number, only 10%. And when you look at the wind, Horn of Africa, Kenya, South Africa, substantial amount of onshore and offshore resources with good quality wind, which makes economic sense in many cases, but perhaps the big part of the renewable resources come from the solar energy. There is no other continent, there is nowhere in the West and in the world where you have more than 320 days a year strong solar radiation. For example, we all know Germany, very strong in the solar energy. The amount of sunshine we receive throughout the Sahara and South Africa is several times higher than that of in Germany. And this is also untapped, most of this potential. So oil, gas, coal, all type of renewables, very rich. But when we look at how much energy they use and the access to energy, the situation is rather poor. Today, in sub-Saharan Africa, only 4 or 5 countries can bring electricity more than 50% of their population. All the rest, more than 40 countries' population, when you look at them, less than 50% of the population, they have access to electricity in the sub-Saharan Africa. This is, of course, a major issue, and according to our statistics, more than 600 million people today, they have no access to electricity. And this is definitely one of the major issues that we dealt with in our work. When we look at the future, we see that all the fuels use are growing. Oil, for example, growing very strongly. Oil demand use in the countries mainly driven by two factors. One, increasing mobility, car ownership. Because today, for example, in Nigeria, rather developed compared to some other countries in terms of income. 30 persons out of 1,000 persons own a car. 30 out of 1,000. In United States, it is more than 700 out of 1,000, and in Europe, of more than 500 out of 1,000. With the increasing income levels, more cars means more oil demand use. Second is I mentioned the biomass use for cooking. More and more LPG will be used. Therefore, strong growth of oil demand is an important factor. Coal is growing. But a big growth in terms of fossil fuels comes from natural gas, especially there are many ongoing projects and other planned projects. We see a lot of gas-to-power projects in East Africa and also in West Africa provide gas to the markets. But all of them, ladies and gentlemen, is only half of the story, if not less than half, because the other part of the half of the total energy use is biomass, with all its consequences. What is biomass? Mainly wood, agricultural waste, and animal waste for cooking. So what is wrong with that? There are many things wrong, but I can tell you one of them. It is as a result of using this wood, agricultural waste, and so on for cooking, leads to respiratory diseases. And this leads to premature deaths in sub-Saharan Africa. According to work we carried out with the World Health Organization, every year, more than 600,000 people, especially women and children, die prematurely because of the pollution created by using biomass in primitive cookstoves. And this is the second main reason for premature deaths in sub-Saharan Africa right after AIDS, and even malaria is the third reason for premature deaths. So biomass is a major issue we try to dealt in the cooking in terms of the better cook stoves, LPGs, that we have discussed heavily in our work and made some suggestions. Now power, electricity. Today when you look at the electricity system, in sub-Saharan Africa, you see two rather unusual trends. The first trend is that the amount of oil, amount of electricity generated from oil is spectacularly high, highest after Middle East. And what is wrong with that? Because economically, it is the least efficient way of generating electricity. This is one. The second thing is the transmission and distribution losses are very, very high, about 20%, which is more than three times than the global average. So this is the situation today, and when we look at, and today it is dominated by coal, mainly by South Africa. When we look at the future, first of all, the capacity power plants are growing substantially, and our estimates show that the growth is about 300 gigawatts. It is what we expect, the growth coming from Latin America, for example. You put Brazil, Argentina, all Latin American countries, their growth in the new capacity is more or less equal to what we expect from the growth in sub-Saharan Africa. And here we see the share of renewables growing substantially, mainly in the rural areas and mini-grid, off-grid solutions as they make economic sense in many aspects, and hydropower is growing. And the main growth areas in terms of power are renewables and natural gas. And this is very interesting because when you look at the history of the economic development of US, Europe, China, their economic growth was mainly based on the using a lot of coal for their economy to grow, income to rise. And in the case of Africa, we expect the income will increase, energy will be brought to the markets, mainly a combination of renewable and natural gas. Now, of course, different parts of the Africa, we look at all the parts and they have different stories. When you look at the West Africa, dominated by Nigeria, mainly gas-associated gas using for power. Then when you look at the Central Africa, hydropower plays a very important role, followed by the East. Again, new discoveries mean lot of gas plus renewables coming there. And in Southern Africa, still coal plays an important role, but less of an important role in the future than it does today. Renewables are growing there too. Climate change and Africa. I think this is an important topic as well. When you look at the climate change and look at who is responsible for what, you look at the cumulative emissions. How much, which country, which region, which region contributed to this problem of CO2 in the atmosphere. When you look at the last 100 years or so, contribution of sub-Saharan Africa to the climate problem was less than 2%, almost nothing. And despite this growth in energy we expect, in the year 2040, the contribution, in quote, of sub-Saharan Africa to the global CO2 emissions will be still less than 3%. Again, peanuts. Therefore, first of all, the first thing to underline is the sins, if I may say so, of the sub-Saharan Africa for creating this problem is negligible. But climate change, if we see look at the impacts of climate change, sub-Saharan Africa is the region number one which will be affected most seriously from climate change impact, especially in terms of the droughts, sea level rise, water stress, and other things. And this means, for example, just giving an example, the droughts and water stress mean major implications for the agriculture sector. Many people expect that as a result of the climate change, we may see some 50% decline in the agricultural output in Africa if we cannot address the climate change. So therefore, Africa doesn't have any contribution to climate change, perhaps the least contribution, but the most affected region in the world if we cannot stop it. Now, when we look at the oil and gas markets, we see that the oil production still strong in the region. Couple of things, though. We think Angola, in terms of crude oil, is overtaking Nigeria as the top producer of the region, mainly because of the new projects seeing the light of the day in Angola. And there are several reasons that the Nigerian production is not going to grow as much as one would like to see, that I will come in a minute. Second issue here is that there are new producers coming in the picture, such as Kenya, Uganda, very important countries with significant production growth. Third one, important point, is that while the production stays more or less the same in the years to come, exports of sub-Saharan Africa will decline, mainly because growing amount of domestic production will be consumed at home, as I mentioned, for the cars, for the LPG, for the other reasons. So more oil will be consumed at home, domestic demand will increase. As a result of that, the exports of sub-Saharan Africa will decline, but still remain one of the mainstays of the global oil market. In terms of natural gas, a very different picture. We expect sub-Saharan Africa is going to increase its gas production substantially, mainly as a result of the new offshore discoveries in Mozambique and Tanzania, in addition to what we see in Nigeria, Angola, the production coming from those countries, and as such emerges as an important LNG exporter. And it is important to have in these days of global gas security becoming, and I believe personally will become more of an issue in the global markets, to have a new exporter. Diversification of the resources is definitely very crucial. And another advantage of the sub-Saharan Africa's gas contribution to the global markets is that from the proximity point of view, very advantageous when it comes to especially South Asia gas imports. As we all know, when it comes to LNG, cost of transportation plays a crucial role in the total economics of LNG, and the proximity here plays a very important role. So, therefore, we think the sub-Saharan Africa can play a significant role in terms of the global gas markets, while a growing share of gas will be used also at home for a domestic consumption, mainly for generating electricity, but also for the industry as well. The direction of the exports is changing as well. When we look at both oil and gas, we see that instead of Europe and North America, oil and gas will go more and more to Asia. Demand is there, proximity is closer, and at the same time, especially for North America, there is not any more need for the debt quality of oil. Now, investments. Now, there is one number which made me in the entire report, when I look at the entire report, a number which made me very happy to find out, when my colleagues found out. It is the following. When you look at the electricity investments, for me, this is the nerve center of the entire story. Electricity investments in the last 10 years averaged about $6 billion per year. $6 billion per year. And during this study, we worked with many companies, many organizations, and so on. We look at the projects which are financially committed. Okay, it's not a forecast of financially committed projects for the next 3 years. And what we see is that the $6 billion jumps up to $25 billion per year. This is a very, very good news. There are many reasons behind that. Perhaps we can discuss during the debate. But this is a very good news. And this is the one-third, two-thirds story I mentioned in the beginning. This will help, and this trend, that reverse, while we still need, of course, money to go for export projects and even increasing manner, we see that the domestic energy projects, especially electricity projects, will get more attention. But even in this, our central scenario, in a growing way, we see that these investments are not enough to address the energy challenges in sub-Saharan Africa. For example, even with this growing investment trend, although we see in the next 25 years or so, about 1 billion people will gain access to electricity, which is a very good number, there will be still, in 2040, more than 500 million people without electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. In 2040, think about this, 2040, 25 years from now, in the world, in one of the continents, 500 million people will still have no access to electricity. I think this is from a, it's not an energy issue only, and it's beyond that. It's a security issue. It's an economic issue. Maybe beyond those, this is a moral issue. So we thought, what can be done in order to get better results than what we have today? So we work with the African governments, with the companies and others. First of all, as I said, our main conviction is that energy is instrumental for the economic and social development of the sub-Saharan Africa. And in order to address this challenge and make the energy provide a positive role here, we think there are three policy buttons to be pushed. And we put them in a context called an African century case, how energy can play a positive role to make the 21st century an African century. Three policy buttons, all detailed in our report. The first one is a reform in the electricity sector. This is critical, both in terms of getting investments, and some countries are doing a very good job here, for example, South Africa, to get the investors, both the domestic private investors as well as international investors, establishing the rule of law. And, as I said, a major problem in Africa is not only building power plants, but making them run. And therefore, the skills, the skilled labor and the capacity building is a key issue, one area to focus. The second area to focus is the deeper regional cooperation. In Africa, there are countries who have substantial amount of natural gas resources or hydropower resources, but they themselves alone cannot find the finance to mobilize those investments. So therefore, we have identified a few of them. If the countries around that resource base, it can be natural gas, it can be hydropower, they can all together find the money, make the project, and they all by X times have returns, including the very host country. So therefore, deeper regional cooperation is crucial for the, again, sub-Saharan Africa, especially for hydro and natural gas resources. Third and the final one is the, especially for the energy exporting countries, better management of their resources. I can give you one example, which is, I believe, very telling. For example, Nigeria. Nigeria's population is today 170 million people. And out of 170 million people, 93 million people, they have no access to electricity. Nigeria has huge oil, gas, coal, renewable resources. Now, at the same time, in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, every day 150,000 barrels oil is being stolen. 150,000 per day. And nobody knows where this oil goes. Many people know where the oil goes, but nobody knows at the same time. So we, and this can be, as we have highlighted in our report, make some suggestions, this can be easily fixed if the things are taken seriously. And if this is fixed, this 150,000 barrels per day means $5 billion revenues, which would be more than enough to bring electricity to all Nigerians. That's just to show you how important it is to have a better revenue management here for the macroeconomy of the country and the well-being of the population. So these are the three major policy buttons, recommendations we detail out to our African colleagues, which I believe, and I saw and I heard it very warmly welcomed by the African Union, African Development Bank, and many, many countries in Africa. So what happens, we said, if those three policy buttons are pushed, then we see a different, very different future for sub-Saharan Africa. In terms of its effect for the economy, sub-Saharan Africa gains one additional extra decade of growth. Huge. GDP per capita increases. Number of people who have no access to electricity decreases substantially. And as a result of better managed oil and gas investment framework, government oil and gas revenues increase also significantly. So this is therefore the way we suggest forward detailed out in our work to the countries in sub-Saharan Africa. So, dear colleagues, if I can put our thoughts, try to put our thoughts together. First of all, we believe energy is a cornerstone, absolutely critical to address the poverty and at the same time the economic growth challenges that Africa has in front of itself. And here, I think the U.S. initiative, Power Africa, is a very important initiative with all its dimensions. We believe improvements in the governance is critical, and I see that more and more countries in sub-Saharan Africa understand the seriousness for themselves of having a more transparent energy markets. Third, biomass. Back to biomass again. the having more efficient cook stoves, going from the existing cook stoves to LPG is extremely important for the health of the sub-Saharan Africans, for economic growth, and putting a lot of stress on the trees, the forest, and so on, and the stocks in the sub-Saharan Africa. We think sub-Saharan Africa will remain one of the mainstays of the global oil production and emerges as a new player in the global gas markets, providing more flexibility, diversification, and as such, enhances the energy security in the world. And finally, we have suggested three important policy initiatives in electricity system, in the political and energy in terms of deeper regional cooperation, and third, on the governance issue. If those policy buttons are pushed, we believe, looking at the resource basis of the continent, we think we may well see that the 21st century can well become century of Africa. Thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
While my colleagues, we want this to be interactive with the audience, let me first introduce my colleague, Amadou Sy, who is a very distinguished person to have at Brookings. He is a senior fellow in the Africa Growth Initiative and currently serves as a member of the editorial board of the Global Credit Review. But if you have an opportunity to look at your program, you will see that Amadou has had a very distinguished career at the IMF and many different capacities, and obviously knows the African continent extremely well. So we're delighted to have him join us today and also be a co-host to this event. While my colleagues are finishing getting mic'd up, I just throw out a couple questions. Fatih, have we gotten the development community on board what you're proposing? Because as you well know, over the years, not to cast aspersions on this or that development agency, but we've kind of had a seesaw back and forth sometimes where big hydro is good, big hydro is bad. We have projections coming out of a lot of places that coal, and particularly at least the prospect when we look to a date like 2040, at least the prospect of perhaps some advances in some aspects, if not clean coal technology, at least much cleaner coal technology. And have we gotten the development community on board of what we should support, what we shouldn't support? Just be interested in that. And then another question, which may not be totally fair, because your report did not touch on North Africa. And yet, when you look at the contribution that Africa as a continent, including North Africa, has made, I wonder if you factor in desertification, particularly whether those numbers wouldn't look somewhat different than they do simply focused only on sub-Saharan Africa. You don't have to answer those right now. We may get to them. But anyway, that's just to throw out a couple points.
If you wish, I can first of all go to the first one. Because it's a very much debated issue. I think Africans should decide what they are going to use, not the development community in Brussels or in North Africa or in Washington or in Tokyo. It should be up to Africans to decide what they want to use. However, we should also say what is good, what is bad. Of course, coal is the dirtiest, in quote, fuel when it comes to carbon dioxide emissions. And it would be very good if that coal use is done in with the clean coal technologies. But we have to be fair here. Even the current coal consumption in sub-Saharan Africa is completely peanuts compared to other parts of the world. If you want to look at the coal consumption somewhere in the world, I think Africa should be the last continent to look into. We have to be, fair there. In terms of the large hydropower, it is very important to make most of the large hydro in a sustained way. But if you look at today, the hydro potential in Central Africa and the lack of access of people and losing their lives, losing their getting engaged to the economy because of lack of electricity, I think to say no categorically to large hydro is not fair, I believe. Let me give you one example. Today, one of the highest hydro potential in the world is in Democratic Republic of Congo. And in DRC, only 10% of the population has access to electricity. So because of this or that reasons, to say no to, categorically no to the large hydro may not be very fair, I would say.
Did either of you have points you want to make or questions you want to raise about the report?
I was just going to second, actually, what Fatih just said. I think what this report shows and what we've seen even in our own development experience is that all of the resources have to be used. And while we certainly don't, the U.S. government doesn't emphasize exploitation of coal, there are cases where it's obvious that that's going to be something that's going to have to contribute. It's going to have to push forward the economic development and be the resource access. So what we've really tried to emphasize, yes, is clean energy, but also the diversification of energy resources. So.
Just to add, I mean, if you remember one of the maps that Dr. Birol showed, I mean, coal is mostly relevant for South Africa and the southern cone of the continent. It's not really the case that all regions of Africa will be coal dependent.
Take a question from the floor. You can either address it generally to the panel or to an individual, but please identify yourself and please ask a question. Yes, sir.
With Gabon, Nigeria, trying to small scale. But it's a challenge. Just finding access. Our outreach to the U.S. government, and whatnot, has been very bureaucratic and very stymied, and this could be deployed quite readily. And I guess my question with that background is, what emphasis is there to help stimulate, I guess, then, I would say, entrepreneurship and trying to get those smaller scale microgrids online, which could augment those higher hydroelectric plants, but could get power generating now as opposed to 20 years from now when the dam is built?
If I can start. It seems to me you've talked about two types of problems. One is the focus on microgrids, and the other is access to capital. Right. So let's do the microgrids first. So we agree with you 100% that it was interesting when we first started talking about Power Africa and how to maximize access to electricity. There was a lot of focus on the national grid and how could you improve that. But in actuality, when you look at a lot of the communities in Africa, you have your urban center where your government planners might want to create an industrial zone, but you don't have that industrialization yet. You have lots of the population living in these segments, doing agricultural work, living in corners where you have to have microgrids. And maybe they'll never be connected to the national grid, but you need some kind of source of power for those communities. So there's a component of our Power Africa initiative that looks specifically at that, that says, you know, we have got to support the development of microgrids so that rural communities, and particularly, I mentioned earlier, women have access to energy. So yes. Now, the financing question is a big one. What we discovered, that's part of the reason why we have the initiative to help put financial resources to projects to help facilitate that process. But we also learned in the week when we had the African Leaders Summit and the U.S.-Africa Business Forum that a lot of boutique financing companies or interests really don't have that much information about what's going on in Africa. And there was a lot more interest during that week about opportunities for investment in microgrids and in energy sources. So we are trying to get the word out. We're working with the Business Council for International Understanding, the Corporate Council for Africa. Penny Pritzker, our Secretary of Commerce, is really pushing in this country and in trade missions to Africa to expose our American investors to opportunities. So, yes, it's a challenge, but I do think as we start promoting more information about what is available, we're going to try to close that gap.
If I can add something, I think you must be really late to come to this meeting because it is what we see is that, and I think I showed that more than 50% of the growth in new generation comes from the distributed generation, off-grids and mini-grids. Why? Very simple, because it makes economic sense, full stop. I mean, it is nothing because we like this, we don't like it. It does make economic sense compared to big, large-scale projects.
Amadou, did you want to add anything? Okay. In the very back, we do have mics if you'll, in the very back against the wall.
Lawrence Freeman, I am the Africa desk at Executive Intelligence Review magazine. I found much of your information very useful, but I would ask you about a different approach than when the one we're pursuing. I mean, if you look at the BRICS development in July and the creation of a new development bank dedicated for infrastructure investment, and then yesterday you had the Asian Investment Infrastructure Bank created, isn't it more feasible that you're going to have government credit is actually going to supply the energy needed? Because the energy we're talking about is so minimal. If you look at Power Africa, which I call Powerless Africa, 30,000 megawatts over six countries, I did a calculation back of the envelope, 1,400 watts of what we consume in the advanced sector here, all of us in this room. So 1,400 watts for Nigeria is 250,000 megawatts. For Sub-Saharan Africa, it's 1,600 gigawatts. We're not going to do it this way. It will never be done by the private sector. South Africa is about to conclude a deal for six nuclear power plants from Russia for 10,000 megawatts, which you didn't include. But I think for us to get the energy we need, and you're correct, this is the key. All the other statistics are meaningless about economic growth. We need infrastructure. Governments have done it in this country, United States, and around the world. China is an excellent example. Don't you think that's the better way to proceed than these small amounts of energy based on private investment?
Well, I went first last time.
So. I go first if you want. Now, I think definitely the government investment is number one. Nobody discusses that. But in many cases, you also need private investors to complement this. In some cases, government finances may not be enough to meet the demand in investment for new capacity growth. You said if you put it in the context, of course, when you compare with Europe or US and other countries, it may look very small, but from those countries' affordability of investments, they may be challenging. Therefore, governments, yes, the main responsible body should be government investments, but in many cases you need private investors to come also make the investments as well. So I don't see that there is a need to exclude one or other, but the government is, of course, it is the main duty of the governments to provide energy to their citizens. This can be through their own financing, direct financing, or through creating conditions that the private sector comes and invests in a responsible way to provide electricity and other energy sources for the population.
Yeah. Lady here.
My name's Li Yang. Just want to mention that a lot of economic development, whether here or African, or whether there's energy or water supply, I think a lot of misuse or abuse. And if you think about it, take advantage of the national debt for the benefit of a few rather than for the general public. So I wonder if we can really both sides from the development of energy plus solving the social issues. I don't want to say this opportunity for private, then private should have enough wealth to develop that. We don't need the subsidies or even tax credit, because in a private public partnership now usually is abused, misused, misleading. And it's for World Bank or for IMF, they have some kind of unjust mechanism to obstruct the citizens' comment or create and contribution. They don't want to hear about that. So I wonder if you can really have a very constructive proposal and get rid of those, eliminate those obstruction or misleading abuse, so we can have a prosper for general public, for African people, not just for a few investors or their team. What I mean team is they are arbitrary consultant or lawyers or financial institution. They are basically victimized people. This is just be honest. In America, it's just the same. And we now talking about 1%, 99% gap. Now
question,
it's more
please.
Serious. So my basic emphasis, try to look ahead of the problem to eliminate or prevent those problems to occur. So can you do a very good proposal and be very preventive of the problems?
So if I understood your question rightly, let me give you one example, for example, which is discussed a lot. The investment of IOCs in the resource richness of the African countries. It's a good thing or bad thing? I think it depends on if, first of all, these investors go there and make a responsible way of investing, developing the projects, it is a very good thing for the population. They get the resources developed and get hard currency in terms of exporting their oil and gas resources, and they find employment. But this agreement between IOCs and the host countries should be made in a very fair way, considering all the factors, the population, local population, entire country, but also there is nothing wrong that the investor gets some fair return as a result of its actions. So if it's a business deal which brings benefits to both the local population, host country, at the same time to the investors, I don't see anything wrong with that. But this should be done in a of course, transparent way, and everybody could benefit from that.
Amadou, I think you had a couple of questions you might want to ask.
Yeah, yes. I have a question for Dr. Birol. One is about how Africa is getting integrated into the global economy. So, I mean, Africa is the third exporter of crude oil. But we've seen, for example, with the tight oil boom in the U.S., Nigerian exports of oil to the U.S. are trickling down. We've seen with the Libyan output disruption that Nigerian exports to Europe are increasing. We've seen that, for example, Angola now exports half of its oil to China. Nigeria exports one-fourth of its oil to India. So it seems that Africa is getting, and these trends are also, if you look at investment, trade, more and more integrated to the world through Asia. And so, I mean, the question I have is, How is it changing the dynamics? I mean, on the one hand, you have the price of oil, which also depends, the demand for oil, which depends heavily on Asia. You have also Asia as an engine of global growth. So what can Africa really look forward to with this new trend?
Thank you, Amado. I think there are two ways here. First of all, in our report, it is very clear that we see a growing trade and maybe political access between Africa and Asia. So it is two ways there. One, the African exports, oil and natural gas, will go more and more to Asia because the need is there. Oil and gas import needs are there. Second, and more importantly, and I will suggest you to look into that, when we look at the investments coming in the African energy sector, China is by far number one compared to other countries. Chinese energy investments are several times higher than those coming from US and those coming from Europe, both private and public investments, especially for the hydropower projects and also some oil and gas projects. Of course, there is nothing wrong with that. It is bringing money investment if they are done within the international rules and regulations and in a fair trade way. But it is important to underline to see that China is playing a crucial role in the energy sector in Africa, and looking at the investments today, the projects, it will increase significantly in the next years to come. There will be definitely some trade implications of that and perhaps some implications beyond those.
Thank you. Kevin Massey with Statoil, a company that has investments in East, West, and North Africa. The question of governance, Dr. Birol outlined this as one of his key conclusions, that governance needs to be improved if this African energy century is to be realized. My question is to Dr. Birol and Ambassador Williams, to what extent is the IEA and the American government involved in helping to shape the governance regimes in these newcomer African countries that have found resources in recent decades? We know the story on the west coast of Africa has not always been one of great governance outcomes, but these new countries, the East African gas discoveries off Tanzania and Mozambique, the oil discoveries in Kenya and Uganda, to what extent are your respective organizations involved in helping the host countries to frame and develop their governance regimes?
That is a major part of our multifaceted energy effort in Africa, particularly with the Power Africa Initiative. Not only is the initiative to try to put together financial resources with projects, but also to provide technical expertise to the governments and on regulatory regimes, on incentives for American investment in their oil projects. That is it's a sustained, ongoing conversation. But what I think has developed, particularly in these newer markets, is sort of the model by example. Everybody is familiar with what has happened in the past and what the way things have evolved, let's say, on the continent with the production and development of oil. So to have the incentive of more American investment and greater use of your profits and access to electricity for your people, we present other kinds of models. And we have found that those discussions are very productive. One of our strongest at this point Power Africa countries is Ethiopia, which has its own sort of issues, but they are certainly taking to heart all of the regulatory discussions that we've been having. So the way to do that really is to have it, to basically to show what the possibilities are, what the incentives are, and to work hand in hand with the governments in technical training.
And with us, what we do is that, and we are, of course, we are an organization of 29 OECD governments, but we work very closely with the African governments. And this issue, we try to share the experiences we had in our own countries. For example, Norway is definitely one of the examples that we, in certain contexts, highlight to those countries.
Yeah, maybe if I can. I mean, I would like to look at this question through two angles. One is that, governance is a very generic term. And, you know, at the end of the day, these natural resources are the property of whom? The property of the Africans who live in the land where these natural resources have been discovered. So I think, the problem is, typically tax, you have this inverse correlation between natural resource and basically if you pay tax, you would go after really, looking at how your taxpayers' tax money is being used. But for natural resources, you have less of this pressure. But I think looking at the local stakeholders, the civil society organization, the political parties, and so on, is very important. The other point I wanted to make is that I think it's useful. And the actually, I want to commend really the team and Dr. Birol. This is a very it's very rich document. But I would like to us to focus also more on sector-specific governance. You know, I mean, it's one thing to talk about, you know, democracy and so on, but there are certain, sector-specific governance issues. For example, state-owned enterprises, utilities. Most of the power generation is owned by the government it is exploited by state-owned enterprises. And sometimes you have governance issues there that are specific to that, rent-seeking and so on. Let me give you an example. Some countries, just because you have to import diesel to generate the electricity, you can have a lot of rent seeking because a lot of a small group of people benefit a lot from this import of diesel.
Yeah. Yes, I'm right here.
Thank you from the South African Embassy. My question is directed more to Dr. Biru as well as the ambassador. Thank you very much, first of all, for the presentation. It was very informative, very rich. I just noted that there was not necessarily reflection. You spoke about regional integration and enhancing regional cooperation, but there was no reflection on Africa's efforts already, the governments of Africa's efforts to do just that. For example, as encapsulated in the Program for Infrastructure Development in Africa. And I thought maybe you could just give the IAA's views on that. And then to the ambassador, perhaps, and I think one of the things that is encapsulated in the PETA, as well as your presentation, the importance of hydropower and how transformative it can actually be. I think I'd like to hear perhaps about Power Africa's views and whether these things and issues were taken into consideration when it formulated its strategy. Thanks.
Okay. I'll go first. The short answer to the second part of the question is yes, actually, Power Africa applies to all sorts of energy sources. So it's a diversified program, and that leads into your second, because what we are looking at in the second phase as the Power Africa initiative matures, and I must say matures quickly because it's only, we've had it for a year, we are looking at ways where we can maximize access, and we're talking about regional cooperation. We're talking about ways to have countries create projects that will go beyond their borders. So what's happening with regional integration? We have a Trade Africa initiative, for example, that right now we're piloting in East Africa to work on all of the impediments to trade within the East Africa region, whether they are tariffs or customs protocols that differ, whether they are just bad road construction and or lack of power access or communication, to have technical expertise that works with those governments to eliminate those kinds of barriers so that those countries can trade among themselves much more easily. that will automatically increase revenues and GDP in that region. So we recognize the importance of regional integration. We also recognize the significant impact that combined sort of power projects could happen, could generate. Our MCC, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, is also looking at ways to more creatively have projects that would cross borders, so that we would be helping these governments, helping countries to work more quickly towards regional integration, but also create a benefit through a power plant.
And when it comes to the some success stories, there are definitely success stories, and I'm sure you want to hear the success stories about South Africa, so I can tell you at least two of them, at least three, in fact three of them, and to be honest with you. First, the electricity pool. This is a very important one, Southern Electricity Pool, which is brings the cost of electricity down and provides electricity to the countries in the region. Second, Tanzania's South Africa, the pipeline is a very good one. And third, South Africa is one of the very few countries which is able to provide a renewable energy scheme. And we see a lot of investment is coming in the picture, and lots of projects are being carried out as a result of this scheme. So these are all very good steps. Taking this opportunity to answer one question that a colleague mentioned, the role of nuclear. We did look at the role of nuclear, but it is we expect only in South Africa we may expect a realistic chance of nuclear power plants to build in sub-Saharan Africa.
One area we haven't really touched upon is the whole area of energy efficiency. And with the rapid economic growth projected for Africa and urbanization, do you sense that there's much interest in governments in putting in state-of-the-art building codes as they build their urban areas, since these things will be in their capital stock for many, many years?
Definitely so, for the buildings and also for the transportation sector, for the cars. And some governments are pushing that, but not at the level that they should be. And this is one of our suggestions. And the same applies to the electricity sector. And I mentioned the transmission and distribution losses are huge. I mean, if you fix that problem, it comes to the efficiency of the transfer and distribution, comes to the levels of the world averages, you don't need to build so many power plants. And this can be fixed easily. And because of that, the electricity prices are very, very high. Today, the sub-Saharan African average electricity prices are higher than those in France, three times higher than China, because of the lots of electricity is being stolen or lost because of the lack of efficiency.
Also, at the Energy Ministerial that we held in Addis in June, one of the workshops and then one of the subtexts of the general agreement that we reached was concentrated on energy efficiency. And there was agreement among the energy ministers who were there, and that did combine actually North African energy ministers as well as all the rest of Sub-Saharan Africa. Yep. Was to share, one of the agreements was to share best practices on sustainable energy use. And that included practices from the U.S. And so there is more focus, and energy ministers actually have to be empowered to by their own governments to be able to really affect the kinds of changes that we were talking about and that they're talking about in their countries.
No, actually, you know, this is a seminal World Bank report on looking at infrastructure in Africa. And, you know, even before talking about really the funding gap, you have to deduct how much you can save by rehabilitation, better maintenance, better management of what already exists. And I think that's a very important issue.
Five. We have two. We can take one and then the other.
Terry Hill with the Passive House Institute. You brought up energy efficiency. My question is, given the potential for solar in Africa, is anybody looking at the role direct energy might play here as opposed to alternating current, direct current versus alternating current? Could Africa be the the start of the switch to direct current? Thanks.
Why don't we take the second question, then the panelists can...
Thank you. Thank you very much. Aloysius Odu, former VP, African Development Bank. I think your three points, the trinity of buttons, you put it, reform of the sector, integration, and managing resources, as the elements that will catapult the African continent to the 21st century. I was a little bit underwhelmed because the AU has a program for 2063. And the role energy will play in that program is absolutely not unclear. We heard here also of the PIDA studies. I was actually thinking of a number of initiatives that will be bold and catalytic to move the continent forward as we approach the 21st, to trigger the sort of emphasis on energy that will really resonate and bring Africa to where it should be. We're talking, if you talk of rivers, for example, on the Geo, which is my only example here, you have 7 major rivers on the continent, the Nile, Niger, Congo, Senegal, Orange, Limpopo, Zambezi. Is there some thinking on how just using these rivers alone, how we can really move the momentum on energy in the continent in order to reap the benefits you outlined?
Perhaps I can give a brief answers to both of them before my colleagues do contribute. Now, first of all, it is very clear from the very reason why we focus on Africa this year is because we believe energy is critical for the economic development of the continent. Full stop. This the very reason, and in the absence of energy, I think Africa, or solving the energy problem, Africa's economy will be underdeveloped for many years to come. Only making more use of energy resources, bringing energy to the citizens, to the economy, can unlock the potential. So, but I think it will be rather unrealistic. From one day to another, everything will change. I wish everything would change, but there are many, many impediments there, and it is the reason why we have chosen 3 areas to push the policy buttons with all the governments going together. And to me, we throughout the year, we were in Africa many times, discussed with the governments, lots of missions, meetings, and so on. If this is realized, this would be a very good dream for all of us who have a heart for Africa. You have mentioned the rivers, other gas potential. It is all there, but to make use of them is another thing which requires some major political steps. For the direct solar, yes, we looked at it, even though currently it is not the mainstream interest of the investors. One can well see the use of direct current in Africa, given the geographical location, geographical size of the continent.
Okay. All the way in the back.
Timothy Chung from Clearview Energy Partners. Dr. Birtle, you mentioned that sub-Saharan Africa has been responsible for something like 2% of GHGs in the last century. In that context, what do you think their role is heading into Lima and next year into Paris?
I think their role should be a demandeur. So they should be pushing the other countries to make a deal, because they will be punished for something that they have no fault in. Therefore, I think if it is important that we have a deal in Paris next year for everybody, it is extremely important for Africa. As I mentioned today, one of the major problems in Africa, we all know, is agricultural sector and the food security. Food security will be in a major difficulty if we are not able to find a solution to climate change. And our reports show that Paris may well be our last chance. Okay, if we were to find a solution to climate change problem. Otherwise, we have to see how we are going to adapt to a world which is different than now, with all its negative implications, primarily on Africa.
And in the back.
Good morning. Dan from Terra Marco. Micro and pico hydro is my question. Rich history in Africa, small use, low cost, 24/7. You talked about major hydro, but what about micro hydro as an option? Has it been looked at? Is it as big as it appears to be?
Exactly. And when our colleague here asked about the mini grid solutions and the distributed generation solutions, there are three major applications there. It is solar, wind, and mini hydro. There's a lot of potential there, and many of them making a substantial economic sense.
Lady right here.
Hi, Madeline Glee from the Center for Global Development. I have a question regarding the definition of modern energy access used in the modeling. I understand that the per capita kilowatt hours is about 100 kilowatt hours per person, and compared to the United States, we use over 1,300 per capita. And looking forward into the future, how are you choosing and why are you choosing to define per capita consumption at that level? And looking forward into the types of policies and reforms that we're shooting for, does setting a per capita consumption at such a low level that wouldn't really be enough to support large productive uses or a more modern lifestyle, do we run into the danger of sort of undershooting that?
I think the undershooting or overshooting, definitely the dangers or risks in both sides. What we have assumed for the access is to meet the very basic needs here in the household. Of course, it is not only our aim is not only bringing access to energy access to households, but also providing energy for the industry or other productive purposes. And it is the very reason why we are saying, in the absence of having energy access to African citizens and plus the industry, it will be impossible to see the economic growth. And it is the reason that throughout the time, we in our modeling work, if you say so, we see an increasing level of the threshold for the minimum energy access, ranging from the individual access to the productive users. Productive users is definitely a key part of our assumption.
Yes, this is very interesting because, if you look at this transformation agenda, so if you look at Africa's growth right now, we haven't really followed the Asian growth model. We haven't been really having increased manufacturing and exports, right? Rather, labor force has left the agriculture, the rural area, to go to the services, which are less energy dependent. So there are lots of questions about is this sustainable? Do we have to move to an Asian growth model? Or, are we really able to grow sustainably with such a huge share of services, So I think going forward, this also has to do, are we going to say, okay, let's build the infrastructure, the energy infrastructure, and they will come? Or do we target certain sectors that we think are going to drive, to transform our economies?
Well, I apologize that We're out of time, given the interesting discussion we've had with our panelists. But I want to thank Dr. Birol and Ambassador Williams and Amadou for contributing. And thank you all very much for your questions and for coming.